This is an ABC podcast.
No ia e Māori, ka salili and good whana morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Coming up on the show today, those involved in one of the world's biggest meth busts face court today in Fiji. And the UNICEF report has come out saying Aotearoa New Zealand has the highest suicide rate for children. And the latest on tsunami reaching parts of the Pacific, that and more coming up shortly. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and I say takia tumas. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, many across the Pacific remained alert last night for any tsunami activity following a massive earthquake in Russia yesterday. Some warnings remain in place for parts of French Polynesia, where Marquesas Island locals were told to brace for waves as high as 4 metres. However, waves that reached the shore were smaller than originally feared. Meanwhile, flights in and out of Hawaii resumed after threats were downgraded, and the Cook Islands, Tonga and Fiji cancelled their tsunami warnings late on Wednesday after sirens sounded throughout the islands. Let's take a listen. Now, Tongans heard this message as the wave front approached the Pacific nation overnight, but luckily, no damage has been reported. Elsewhere in the region, other Pacific nations were able to breathe a sigh of relief, with tsunami watch and advisories cancelled for Palau, Guam and the Northern Marianas Islands. But that's not to say the fears weren't justified. According to Chris Elder, Professor of Geology at Curtin University, it was the sixth most powerful to ever be recorded.
The earthquake was relatively shallow, so at a depth of about 20 kilometres, but it was a magnitude 8.8 earthquake, which makes it one of the largest earthquakes that's being recorded. The bigger earthquakes of 9.2, for example, caused the Boxing Day tsunami in Sumatra in 2004, so this is getting close to that level.
And aftershocks are still expected in the far east region of Russia, where the quake struck. But Tonga's National Disaster Risk Management is hopeful they'll pose no danger to the Pacific.
For me, I don't think that there will be a possibility for another earthquake that can generate a tsunami from that area.
And for more on the impact of yesterday's magnitude 8.8 earthquake and tsunami in the Pacific region, we cross now to our reporter in Tonga, Marion Kupu. Malo tau mai bongbongini, Marion.
Malo tau mai o mo fafetai bongbongini, Aggie.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, firstly, I am glad to know that you are safe. But look, the advisory listed Tonga at about 9:40 p.m. in the evening, you know, to expect a potential wave. Was it like waiting for something to happen?
It was tense, Aggie. People were still awake and were alerted. The first siren went off around afternoon yesterday. I'm thinking it was around 2 p.m. yesterday. And immediately I have noticed, because I live across one of the biggest Catholic school in Nukualofa, I've noticed all the students have started lining up and evacuating the route that they have been practicing or in drills in the few months ago, and I've seen vehicles starting to queue up on the road, and it was pretty sure it's to pick up the children from work or family members from school, or family members from work and heading out away from the shoreline. And that happened really quickly yesterday.
Well, and that's great to hear, because I believe, despite a bit of a long wait, you know, you said the Tongan authorities moved quite quickly when the advisory came out. So how quick were you evacuated?
Oh, I have to give it up to the Tongan authority. They worked out as a team, activating first the siren and then directing the people to listen to the local radios for more detailed updates. They were posting on Facebook, on social medias, routes and maps on where to go. They've also made announcement on local radio halls, community halls, church halls, and even sport facilities that were open for the people that did not have any families inland or in safer areas. So, you know, we've been updated since 2 p.m. yesterday on an hourly basis throughout the whole day yesterday. Like the whole nation and the whole media just stood still, and all we can hear is just updates from the government, from the authorities in where. And then even like they were advising people, if you need help, we had the army out, we had the police out, you know, just in case somebody needs some kind of assistance for evacuation. So they were very mobilized yesterday.
Sounds like a very orderly process that was happening from the authorities and that. But can I ask, when the time came, though, Marion, were there any reports of a wave? Did anyone see anything?
No. Obviously, it was raining and windy yesterday. I did had a little drive on the towards the shore. This is during the daylight. Of course, safety is of paramount to me. But yes, I did see that the waves were very rough seas, but not anything out of the ordinary. Definitely, there were rough seas, but nothing out of the ordinary. But later, last night at almost 11 p.m. last night, there was reports that a wave did make it to one of the northernmost islands of Tonga, which is Niuafo'o, near Toptapu. I think there was a little bit of wave that touched their shores, but no damage has been reported.
Marion, I know that Tonga, you know, has had previous experience dealing with a tsunami. You know, if we think back to the Hunga Tonga, Hunga Ha'apai volcanic eruption, I mean, in any way, did that experience help towards what you guys were going through last night?
Oh, yes, definitely. You know, people remembered, especially those that experienced the Hunga Tonga, Hunga Ha'apai, and they knew exactly what could happen. So they remembered, and it did help. I can see less panicking than the Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai, and I can also see how orderly it was for the people. And not only that, you know, I've seen on social media people posting, oh, it's time to get our 72-hour bag, which is basically all the necessities for the next 72 hours, which is always encouraged. Like, these are the things that we have already have experienced and we learned from, and then immediately it was activated when we had the tsunami warning, and this was a real serious tsunami warning. I mean, we've also experienced earthquakes. Once we hit an earthquake, whether if it's a 5.4 or whatnot, you know, we were immediately stay on alert for tsunami warning. And of course, we have our 72-hour bag ready on the side. Vehicles are getting pumped for gas, water, everything, you name it. We're pretty much ready now.
Well, it is really good to hear that our homeland is safe and you are all well, Marion. But look, I just say mālo apito. Thank you so much for all the hard work you're doing there and looking after our people.
Malo apito, Egi, Ofatu.
That is our ABC's reporter in Tonga, Marion Kupu.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia. Hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music. From across the eras to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubois. We head to Fiji now, where the men allegedly involved in attempting to smuggle 4 tonnes of methamphetamine into the country in one of the world's biggest ever meth busts will know their fate in court today. The men were charged in January 2024 with plotting to import the drugs worth an estimated $1.3 billion through the tourist hotspot of Demerara Island. The trial, which started in May, has exposed the routes drug cartels are using, with the Pacific increasingly becoming a transit point onto the more lucrative Australian market. So joining us now from Fiji is our reporter, Lide Movono. Did I say, Yandra Lide?
Yandra Vinaa Egi, good to be talking to you again this morning.
Yeah, thank you. Definitely, this is a big, big case today. What can we expect from court today?
Aggie, it's been a very tough few months. This case has been high profile and quite complex. So there's a lot of anticipation building up as we await the verdict in what you've correctly described as the biggest drug case in Fiji's history and most probably in the Pacific. So at the High Court in Lotoka today, we can expect to hear the verdict. The judge should give his ruling in what has gripped the country for months, and 4 tons of crystal methamphetamine allegedly smuggled into Fiji in late 2023 means that the 7 men who have been on trial are facing what is probably one of the highest sentences in the history of our criminal justice system. As you pointed out, the shipment worth $1.3 billion Australian dollars is the largest ever seized in the Pacific. So we can expect that today's verdict will be one of the most important that will set the Fijian judicial system deals with international crime syndicates, Agnes.
Yeah. Lide, can you let us know what have been some of the key revelations to actually come out of this trial?
It read like a movie, Agnes. The scale and sophistication of this alleged drug operation shocked very many people, including myself. We learned that the meth arrived by sea, transferred from a foreign flag luxurious superyacht to a barge off Fiji's western waters. It was then brought ashore, but hidden in plain sight, Agnes, in nearby residential properties on Demerara Island, one of Fiji's most exclusive tourism enclaves and the mecca for a lot of international visitors, including Australians. There were also some dramatic courtroom moments, including when accused persons started to dob on each other and claim that they were being forced and threatened at gunpoint by men with ties to the Russian mafia. There was a key state witness who was granted immunity and who described the sophistication in which the drugs were moved and stored in what is probably plain sight right here on Fiji's tourism hub.
Wow, that does really sound, you've painted it like a movie, for sure. But, you know, people are feeling on the ground, like what has been the public reaction to this trial?
There's been a huge public reaction. People are calling for more off of our police, off of our judiciary. There's also been a real sense of unease because the lead up to the trial was not without drama. There were at least 2 attempts by one of the accused persons, the ringleader, in fact, to flee the country. Same person twice, Agnes. So for many Fijians, this trial is confirming what we feared for a while, that Fiji is now being exploited by some of the most powerful drug cartels out of Mexico, and that the drug trade is no longer something distant, Agnes. People are also anxious about what this case means for Fiji in terms of our law enforcement, in terms of our ability to push back on the drug trade, and also in terms of corruption and accountability, Agnes, because we've had instances where evidence from this particular case and others like it disappear from police containment. You know, whether the justice system can hold this space and keep Fiji safe is something that is pretty much on trial here too, Aggie.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? This trial really has been seen as a test for how Fiji will address the drug trade. So again, how significant will the outcome of this trial be?
Well, I think it's made it painfully clear that Fiji is not a stopover point anymore. Now the big drug cartels are using Fiji as a hub, and $1.3 billion or 4 tons is quite a lot to move into a country this small. So what's significant about this is our ability to handle cases of this scale and also of this complexity. It's a litmus test of sorts. So a strong outcome would restore, you know, the people's confidence in our judiciary and in our police, but also signal to our international partners like Australia, which had been the intended destination, that Fiji can handle serious organized crime cases, Aggie.
And then, of course, to those who are involved, I mean, the impact around that whole transnational drug trade, you know, having on Fiji, I mean, that, can you correct me if I'm wrong, they've all pleaded not guilty?
There were 10 of them in total. Well, initially, they had rounded up about 16 to 17 persons. And as the investigations went on, three key witnesses became state witnesses and they were given immunity from trial. And then just as their evidence started to come out, another three pleaded not guilty. But Agnes, you know, there was a movement back and forth, people pleading guilty and then pleading not guilty. But eventually, the state prosecutor took seven people to trial. So it's seven people that we will hear today, whether they will be jailed. And that's very highly likely because our laws send people to jail for cases involving more than 1 kg. And this is 4 tons. So there's a lot to hear this morning, Agnes.
Okay, well then, do we know or can we expect what time today, we'll know the verdict by?
Absolutely. We're an hour away now from the opening of the High Court here in Lautoka, and we expect that this case will be the first up. The ruling should take a while for the judge to read, given that there are seven different accused persons in the same case. So I can't say a specific time, but by lunchtime, Agnes, we will know if this landmark case has been successfully convicted in Fiji's High Court.
Well, look, always great, Lee, there for you, keeping us updated on what is happening there. But yeah, we'll find out later on today.
Vina valevu, Agnes.
Vinaka, that is our Fiji correspondent, Lee Movono, keeping us up to date on all the latest with this case across the day here on ABC Radio Australia. A Pacific think tank has cast serious doubt on Guam's proposed missile defence system, saying it won't provide the US territory protection from a major attack in the event of a conflict. Now, the Guam-based Pacific Centre for Island Security made the claim after scrutinising the government's final environmental impact statement into the project. And the centre's director, Robert Underwood, fears the military has overlooked the protection of Guam's citizens in favour of other military projects in the region.
The overblowing claim by Department of Defense officials is that this provides airtight defense from missile attacks. Yet, you know, there's been a lot of criticisms about whether it can actually do that. And those have been widespread and they continue. They're outlined in a U.S. Government Accountability Office report. There are also many reports on this by the Union of Concerned Scientists. But the most revealing part of the overall DOD strategy is while they proclaim that this is designed to defend the homeland of the United States and the people of Guam, they are at the same time planning for divert airfields into Nian and in Yap and in Palau in order to disperse their assets in case of an attack. It also is important to note that they kept advertising that the conflict between the United States and China over a possible invasion of Taiwan was imminent, that it could happen in this year or next year or the following year, and that this is why this enhanced integrated air missile defense system is so critical to establish now. And then as you read the report, it's going to take 10 years to stand up, even if it goes according to plan.
But you also said that it fails to protect against, you know, a complex saturation attack, which, given what we've seen around the world now in places like Iran and Israel, I feel like the world has a bit of an idea of what that kind of looks like now. So in an event of a major conflict, is that sort of attack a high possibility? And is that the exact type of attack that you would need it to defend against?
If there were a out-and-out conflict between China and the United States and they attacked Guam and the Chinese missiles came in, they would come in at such a rapid speed. And, of course, we're talking about China. We're not talking and their capacity. We're not talking about the kinds of attacks that are endured in Israel or even in the Ukraine. It would simply overwhelm whatever they have here. They could shoot in 300-400 missiles, and a lot of them would be decoys and dummies, and you'd really exhaust your capacity to defend against those pretty quickly, which speaks to the need for divert airfields and the fact that they're going to disperse their assets, because the number one priority of the Department of Defense is not the protection of the people of Guam. It's the protection of their assets and their capacity to retaliate against China in case of conflict.
Well, you did make the observation that need to disperse their assets, as they're doing in places like Palau, Yap, and Tinian, underscore this project's limitations in a lot of ways. Do you worry, though, that the US is choosing to invest in those alternative projects as opposed to, you know, pumping the money into Guam and beefing it up to a point where it should need to worry?
I think it reveals that no matter how what kind of missile defense system you construct, it's not going to be foolproof. And I think no matter what you and this discussion has been around since the time of discussion of Star Wars in the 1980s. And what it also does is that it places false hope in a process of security in which, you know, the competition with China is economic and diplomatic as well as military strategic. And the United States' response is almost entirely military. And the thinking that goes behind it is really defensive in nature rather than forward-looking. So we're in the second island chain, in which, of course, Guam is the cornerstone. But what it does in the broader context is it really puts out of focus diplomatic and economic competition and just humanitarian efforts. So the U.S. Positioning in this part of the world is almost entirely in uniform. There's no more humanitarian efforts. There's no diplomatic initiatives. There's not even American business investment. And so as a general understanding of the process, this has not been a good look for the United States. And it's putting all its eggs into a missile defense system, which is untested and which most scientists don't believe is actually feasible.
You also mentioned in your press release that it raised some social concerns in terms of the impact it's going to have on housing and the environment. Can you expand on that a little bit?
It's important to understand that military personnel get anywhere from, you know, $2,500 to $3,000 housing allowance, and they're able to go into the local economy and basically, you know, dry up all the available housing, and local people are not able to compete at that level. And so what is the military response? Oh, we'll provide some housing, on-base housing. We'll work it out in the future. Well, the future is here now. And then the other part of it is that trying to understand what about the personal safety of the people of Guam? Where are the shelters? Even in Israel, where you have a mature Iron Dome, you have shelters. Ukraine, they have shelters. In Taiwan, they're building shelters. In Japan, they're building shelters. In Guam, they're not building shelters.
And that is Robert Underwood, Director of Guam-based Pacific Center for Iron and Security, speaking with Carl Evans.
Pacific Beat.
Now, please note that this story does discuss the issues of suicide. Now, in a new UNICEF report, it shows that Aotearoa New Zealand has the highest suicide rate for children. The Child Wellbeing at Risk in an Unpredictable World report places New Zealand 32nd out of 36 OECD countries, with a child suicide rate almost three times higher than the average. It also ranks the country as last place for child and youth mental health, with Māori and Pacific communities disproportionately affected. Now, to discuss this more, we have on the line is Dr. Claire Ahmad, Chief Children's Commissioner at Manamokopuna Children and Young People's Commission. With that, I say kia ora, Doctor, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Kia ora, Agnes. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, absolutely. Doctor, I must say, these are really startling numbers. I mean, are you surprised by this or not?
Unfortunately, I wasn't surprised when I saw the findings of this report, but that doesn't mean that I'm not deeply concerned. And I am so concerned about what we see in this report and across a range of other data and evidence relating to child wellbeing in Aotearoa New Zealand, because what it shows is that we are still lagging behind our counterparts across the OECD. And in this report in particular, it's highlighting, as you said earlier, that Aotearoa New Zealand is sitting at the complete wrong end of this table when it comes to the mental well-being of our children and young people, our mokopuna in Aotearoa New Zealand. And you know, our government has said that they want New Zealand to be the best place in the world to be a child. I absolutely share that aspiration, but this report shows that we are far away from that goal.
Which is really unfortunate, you know, as a child who grew up in Aotearoa and having to know that these numbers are actually a lot more real than we want to, you know, admit sometimes. From this report, then again, does it actually really talk about, you know, the contributing factors of what leads our children to have to, you know, turn to such an unfortunate phase in their life?
The report doesn't delve into so much of that part of it. It more presents the data. But in my role as Aotearoa New Zealand's Chief Children's Commissioner, a huge part of my work is to be around the country in communities with mokopuna, with children and young people themselves, hearing directly from them about what's going on in their lives, their aspirations, their hopes, but also their challenges. And in my conversations with mokopuna since I've been in this role since November 2023, I've consistently heard from our mokopuna here that they are deeply concerned about the state of youth mental health and wellbeing in Aotearoa, New Zealand. So this is a real-time issue. It's affecting children and young people from a range of communities. And unfortunately, it's not going away at the moment. And mokopuna, they are so powerful when they talk to me about these things. I was just reflecting on something that mokopuna Samoa shared with us recently, and they said, this is a direct quote, they said, "We too are concerned about what goes on in our world, especially in our country. What happens now will affect our future. Most of us aren't stereotypical or ignorant." And what that highlights is that too often mokopuna themselves aren't feeling that we are listening to them, that we're not taking their solutions for change seriously. And mokopuna are often talking to me about things like poverty and the stress that that brings into their households and into their families and whānau and their lives. If we look at our rates of child poverty in this country, we know that they are tracking in the wrong direction with the cost of living crisis, the ongoing impacts of the pandemic. These things have a direct bearing on the lives of children and young people, and unfortunately, they inequitably impact children and young people. So, for example, our mokopuna Māori, our Indigenous children in this country, and our mokopuna Pacific are often much more impacted by things like poverty, by housing insecurity, and by intergenerational trauma. So we must consider that bigger context that sits behind how our children and young people are doing in Aotearoa, New Zealand today.
Yeah. Well, Doctor, I've seen you and I've heard another interview that you've done. You spoke about, you know, meaningful investment into children. Mm. What did you actually mean by this in terms of child well-being?
When I talk about meaningful investment, what I mean is actually prioritising our children in government investment, and I haven't seen enough of that from the government to date. What I have seen is they have put a clear focus in their child and youth strategy on reducing poverty and material hardship that affects children, on addressing child maltreatment, and on focusing on the first 2,000 days. These are all excellent priorities, which I totally welcome, but now I want to see them take that next step and meaningfully invest money and resources and also policies that will actually have a direct positive impact in the lives of children and young people. So if we take that to the context of mental health and well-being, what I want to see there are investments and policies that are going to significantly reduce wait times for children and young people to access mental health support, a stronger focus on prevention and early intervention for children and young people, and making that support equitable, as well as addressing these underlying issues that I've also spoken about.
Mm. Well, Doctor, this is the thing. I understand that there is really no one silver bullet answer, right, to solve this. But are there things from other countries who, like you say, on this report, we sit on the other end, but those who are at the top, who are ranking a whole lot better than us, are countries like Denmark and Netherlands. What are they doing that possibly we could learn from, you know, that we could implement into the well-being of our children?
I think there's two things that countries like some of those Scandinavian Nordic countries do when it comes to the well-being of their children and young people. First of all, they've made a central commitment to prioritise children and their rights as rights holders under the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, for example, to prioritise those in their government policies and approaches. And this has been consistent for many decades across successive governments. I think that in Aotearoa New Zealand, and I'd say as well across the Tasman and Australia, for too long successive governments have not put children at the heart of their policies and approaches and investments. So that's the first thing. And then something that some of those Scandinavian countries also do really well is that they plough a much higher proportion of public finance, public government investment into policies and programs and supports that specifically focus on children and young people. And if we look, for example, at our poverty rates in comparison between Aotearoa New Zealand and some of those Scandinavian countries, their poverty rates for children are much, much lower. And so right there, that shows we have to address these underlying causes that are sometimes, unfortunately, can lead to poor mental health outcomes for children.
And earlier you were talking about policies. I'm wondering then, has the government picked this up? Are they moving forward? Are they doing anything about this?
Well, a few weeks after this UNICEF Innocenti report card was published, the government did publish its new suicide prevention action plan. Now, I think that publication had already been planned long before the UNICEF Innocenti report card came out. I'm pleased to see in that updated suicide prevention action plan that there is a key focus on children and young people when it comes to prevention. But what I don't see in that action plan is enough of a really tangible focus on how the government will drive investment in policies that are going to make a really strong change in this area.
Well, you know, when we talk about an issue like this, such as suicide or even self-harm, what are you seeing? Like, what are the impacts this is having on families, communities, really the country as a whole?
Well, I think the first thing to say there is that I'm really conscious that we must take absolute care when discussing this topic of suicide, because it is really sensitive and it has a huge ripple effect in the lives of people who it affects. And I hear that from families, from parents whose children have died by suicide around the country. They talk to me about those deep ongoing ripple effects in their lives, the grief that it leaves them with, the questions that it leaves them with. And I also have been hearing from children and young people around the country that they are often aware of a young person in their community who has taken their life by suicide, or their friends who are experiencing suicidal ideation. And they're conscious about these higher rates of suicide for rangatahi Māori, for rainbow children, and for those who are experiencing these things inequitably in their lives. And what they say to me as their independent advocate is that they want to access good mental health support early, but for too many of them, it's just not available for them, or they don't know how to access it. They also talk to me about the importance of they themselves as children and young people being equipped with good knowledge around this kaupapa, this issue, because often they are that first line of that their friends will confide in them as their first line of people who they seek support from. So I think as well, equipping our children and young people with good knowledge around this issue, and then how to connect their friends and peers with support that's going to work for them, is absolutely crucial too.
Some great tips there, Commissioner. Really appreciate it. I know that's all the time that we have for this morning, because it is a conversation that needs to continue to happen. But thank you so much for the work that you do there back in Aotearoa.
Nui te mihi, Agnes. Thank you.
Ngā mihi. That, of course, is Dr. Claire Ahmad, a Chief Children's Commissioner at Manamokopuna Children and Young People's Commission. Now, if any of these issues has raised concerns for your child or children, yourself or others, please contact the following. For PNG, there is One Talk Counsellum Helping Line. The number is 7150 8000. In Solomon Islands, the South Blees 24-hour hotline is 132. To Samoa Victim Support Group on 800-7874, or for Fiji, National Crisis Toll, a free line for suicide prevention. It is 1543. You've been listening into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Want all the latest Pacific news, sports and entertainment delivered in your inbox every Thursday? ABC Pacific have launched a free weekly newsletter with exclusive content from across the Pacific by your favourite ABC presenters. Be the first to know about upcoming events and competitions in your area, plus much more, absolutely free and direct to you. It's easy to sign up. Just go to abc.net.au/pacific and enter your email to join today.
Vinaka Vaka Levo, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, a new miniseries called Chief of War will air this Friday. Well, tomorrow, in fact. And it stars Jason Momoa, who acts as Kaiana, a rebellious chief who goes to war with Hawaii's king, Kamehameha. The miniseries is a dramatization of real historical events. And among the main lineup actors in the film is Tongan American Siwa Ikaleo, who plays Nahi Olea, the younger brother of Kaiana. Whinau Whanua spoke with Mr. Ikaleo to learn more about his journey.
If this island is divided, this kingdom will fall.
I was training, and they trained me with stunts, stunt fighting. They kind of taught me a little bit about how to dance around the camera when we're doing stunts, how to throw a punch and make it look authentic. And on top of all of this stuff, we were also learning Hawaiian martial art called lua. And it was a crash course for sure, because we had only about a month to do all of this preparation.
That's interesting that working on this miniseries, you're actually reliving a lot of the ancient practices, like you mentioned, the Hawaiian martial arts. So you learned a lot about the Polynesian past that you may not have been aware of?
Of course. I grew up in Tonga. I know as much as I took in from when I grew up in Tonga about Tongan history, but there's also so much of Tongan history that I don't know about. And joining this TV show, it opened my eyes and also my heart too, because everybody talks about we're the navigators of the Pacific Ocean, and then we just leave it at that. But now I have a little bit more of a curiosity towards how exactly that may have happened and how we're related to each other and who traveled where and all of that stuff. But this definitely was a reach for me to find out more about my ancestry.
And for your acting career, you may be, who knows, the next Jason Momoa. Could you describe how you got into acting? And
I appreciate that. And I love that you said maybe the next Jason Momoa, but I want to, there's only one Jason Momoa. He's one of a kind. One thing I learned so beautifully from Jason that is I'm unique and uniquely me. So I appreciate that while I was working with him, and he helped me get to some scenes. Some of my other castmates, we've all gotten close to each other, but that's a big compliment to say I'm be the next Jason Momoa now, and I'll take it. But how I got into acting is goes all the way back to when I was younger. I grew up in Tonga, so just to give a quick brief about me, I was born in the United States, but I was raised in Tonga. You know, just being a teenager and all the things that, you know, happens around people who are developing. And at the time, I was more of a awkward, socially awkward type. And I first figured out that acting or being in any capacity of performing a story while I was in high school. And one of my teachers was teaching me and some of my friends this skit called The Jacket. And once we got to perform this in front of a congregation of different schools in Tonga, it's a Christian play. And towards the end of that, I looked out into the hundreds of people that were in front of me, and I saw that whatever we just did connected with them, which is one of the biggest things that I struggled with at the time was communication. And I saw that I was connecting with this audience. Something I did made sense to them. I think it was a revelation to me that this is a path for me. Whether it was going to be a career or not, I just enjoyed putting on stories and performances. So that's not too long-winded of a story.
No, it is. It's actually quite fascinating because how you talk about you're a socially awkward and quiet kid, but when you act, you have to pretend to be something that you're not. Maybe a character that's completely different, loud and boisterous character. How do you do it? How do you change your personality to fit a character that's different from you?
I can tell you that some might say I'm still very much socially awkward and weird, but
so am I. So you're not alone.
I tell you what, like, that comes with the territory, and whoever is in my circle will love me anyway, you know. I would say yes, you know, there are many different characters and characteristics, and some of them could be completely opposite of me, and some of them could be way off and to the left of my normal personality. But what I found out while, you know, continuing to, whether I'm doing little short films or student films, and then I'm also studying acting, and then I got to do this big project with Jason Momoa, Takoa Tuaka, and the whole list. Temuera Morrison is on the show, Cliff Curtis, Luciana Buchanan. So what I found out while I'm creating these characters, that all of these characters are particular and specific parts of me that I'm going to filter to this performance or what the story needs. And sometimes it's parts of you that you don't like, but it does definitely, there is a process, and sometimes you got to have like a safety net to kind of get back to yourself, to your real self.
And that was Siwa Ikaleo, one of the main cast in the new Hawaiian miniseries, Chief of War.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
All right, the Cook Islands has declared war on the Crown of Thorns starfish, known locally as Taramea. Divers and volunteers have been racing to protect coral reefs around Rarotonga, with the reefs under pressure from both the predatory starfish and climate-related impacts. Authorities are accelerating efforts ahead of spawning season to preserve marine ecosystems. Dr. Teina Rongo from Environmental Ngā Korero o Te Rau, who leads Operation Taramea, joins me this morning. There I say, kia ora, Dr. Rongo, mōpongi manea.
Hey, kia ora ana, mōpongi to everyone listening.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. I mean, Doctor, can you describe the current scale of the Taramea infestation? I mean, how does it compare to past outbreaks in Rarotonga?
Yeah, we've had two outbreaks in our history, one in the 70s and then one in the 90s. Both outbreaks completely decimated our reefs, but we got onto this one very early, and so to manage the population. And right now, we have removed 17,000 of these taramea. It's been almost 6 years that we've been doing this.
Can you tell us maybe, like, what's the methods your team uses to locate and have to remove the taramia? I mean, how do you process them afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I know that the Great Barrier Reef have developed some technologies to and methods to remove the crown of thorns, but our method is very simple and it's faster. So it's basically a stick with a little hook at the end on one side to take the taramia off the reef. And we string him up and we bring him up to land and we basically use them as fertilizers for our taro planting areas.
Wow. And keep going, Doctor, sorry.
Yeah, we do have a little bit of science, so we record everything. We measure their sizes, so we have an understanding of how these things are moving and also the ages of these taramia.
And Doctor, I know that you've actually surpassed, your original goal of removing 10,000. I know you just mentioned there 17,000 taramia. Like, again, what was like the key factor behind this success?
Really, when we started this operation, it was actually part of a youth program that we were running because we started moving into certifying our youth to do scuba diving. Scuba diving in the Cook Islands is normally reserved for tourists. And so the tourists are the ones that are seeing our reefs. And yet we, the locals, are the one making decisions on these reefs. And so we saw that it was important that our people start seeing these reefs. And so we ran this program, a scuba diving program for our youth. While we were out there doing the certification, and we noticed that there was taramia, and so we just moved on it. And so our program have continued to in terms of scuba diving, to bring more of our youth into scuba diving. And part of the activities when they're certified is actually to go and remove the taramia.
And I like that because, yes, Operation Taramia, right? As you help the local youth become sort of divers. Can you just speak, though, to the role of that, like the community engagement and how this really has helped build, I suppose, resilience?
Yeah, so this is really important for us because for us, our program that we run is called Atu Ianga Ki Te Tanga, which translates to connecting people to their environment and then culture as well. But in order for us to know exactly what is happening to our environment and to have that relationship with the environment, we need to have activities that can foster that appreciation for the environment. And so that scuba diving program is really important for us. But we do other things as well. Our kids get to voyage and what have you. They go fishing, all of which are part of this effort to connect people. So the community's involvement is really through the youth, and we do awareness in the community as well so that people understand why we're doing this. It's not just to protect our reefs, but also give our reefs a fighting chance against the impact of climate change, which is something that's out of our control.
Absolutely.
Right.
And Doctor, looking ahead, what measures, perhaps involving, if it comes down to government policy or even reef management, do you believe these things are necessary to prevent future outbreaks?
It is. What we are doing, in fact, is almost band-aid fix because the problem for the outbreak, it really stems from poor land use practices. And this is where government comes in because it's their responsibility to ensure that we are looking after the land and the activities that we are doing on land is not compromising our reefs because part of the reason why we have these outbreaks is because there's too much nutrients going into the marine environment. And so, government has to step up and do their part. So we're non-government organizations. We are actually the ones out there doing the work. And some of it is actually work that government is supposed to do. But government is spread out thin, and so they're not able to cater to all the activities that they're supposed to be doing. So, those responsibilities falls onto NGOs.
Mm.
So Yeah, as long as government is implementing and doing their work on land, such as, you know, looking after the sewage, the septic tanks that people have, making sure that they are not overflowing, and also looking after, you know, the environment, particularly around wetland habitats that are today being developed. You know, as we as a country, as we develop, we end up filling these very important habitats, like such as our Paitaro areas, which are important. Basically, the filters of whatever, you know, comes out from the land, they get filtered in these spaces before they go out, because our reefs don't need extra nutrients. It's a system that recycles nutrients. It doesn't need added nutrients. And so these nutrients overloading is the result of the crown of thorn outbreak. So we're doing our part to keep this reef alive so that it has a fighting chance, as I mentioned, to, you know, to adapt to the impacts of climate change.
Absolutely. And look, Doctor, you guys are doing great work there. And just congrats again on being able to remove 17,000 taramea. But look, that's all the time that we have for this morning, Doctor, but we really do appreciate your time. Metaki.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you. And that was Dr. Teina Rongo from environmental NGO Korero o Te Orau here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Break is back for 2025. And this year, it's bigger, louder, and ready to uncover the best new talent from across the Pacific and Timor-Leste.
Think you've got what it takes? You could be the next rising star to win an all-expenses-paid trip to perform at WOM Adelaide, Australia's biggest international music festival.
Head to abc.net.au/Pacific Break to enter. But don't wait too long.
Entries close Monday, August 25th, so send in your original tracks now.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, tsunami threats have been downgraded across the Pacific, but warnings remain in place for parts of French Polynesia after massive earthquakes struck Russia's far east coast yesterday.
It was a magnitude 8.8 earthquake, which makes it one of the largest earthquakes that's being recorded. The bigger earthquakes of 9.2, for example, caused the Boxing Day tsunami in Sumatra in 2004. So this is getting close to that level.
Find our top stories on Pacific Beat when you type that into your search engine. We're back tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned. Your news is next. After that, it's Nisha Daily. You've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Join me, Melissa Makin, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference.
Search up ABC Nisha Daily Afternoon Edition to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.